Well, well, well. My name is David, and I am an alcoholic and addict. Now, what I'm supposed to do is talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But I'm going to start with a number, 9,990. 9,990. The number of days I have clean today. Amazing thing. Amazing thing. September 16th, 1989 was my last use. And that is strictly a miracle and blessing beyond my capacity. I can't tell you how much. Now, a little bit of what it was like, and I hope not to get too bogged down in that stuff, but, you know, I figure I need to state my qualifications here. Three treatments. First one when I was 17. My uncle and I had gotten into a little bit of an altercation one evening. I forgot I was grounded that night. I just forgot, you know? I was at work, and I was supposed to come back home right after work, and then suddenly it was 2 o'clock or something like that. I don't know exactly. And when I got home, his eyes were redder than mine. See, my uncle Tommy was an alcoholic. And he used to have this 5-gallon bottle of vodka on his bar with a little pump squirter on it. And every day when he came in, that was the first thing. It didn't matter what juice or soda or whatever else, he just pumped it up. So, you know, that kind of gave me license as well. Not that I didn't start earlier than that. But we had this altercation, and he said, you know, the next day that we should probably go do some family counseling. And I said, sure, you know, I'd be happy to tell people how weird you are, no problem. And we're supposed to go after school that day, but instead he picked me up from school. And it was really bad timing, because I had just scored, and, you know, I had this in my sock, it was really cool. And I brought a brand new cherry wood pipe, you know, and we go into the city, and we're at River Edge Hospital. And we're sitting in the waiting room. Psychiatrist comes out, introduces himself, and takes me back. And I thought, well, great. I have an opportunity to tell him all these terrible things about my alcoholic uncle. So I go in, and I'm whining and complaining about, you know, all the stuff that's gone wrong. Then they send me out, and they take him back there. And I'm waiting and waiting a little bit, and then they call me back again. And I'm like, okay, now we're going to get him. It's going to be me and these two doctors against my uncle. We're going to get it, right? And I get back there in the office, and my uncle's not there. And I'm wondering, well, what happened? They said, just wait here for me. So I'm waiting. I'm sitting in the office and looking around, and, you know, nobody comes. Nothing's going on. So I decide to go check the door and, you know, see if they're down the hallway. Well, the door was locked. And I said, uh-oh. And then I looked at the windows, and there were bars on the window. And I said, oh, stuff. And so I sat down. I said, well, okay, I'm just waiting. And Dr. Iapelli, I remember Dr. Iapelli very well, came back in with a security guard. And I'm sure he was maybe 6'1 or 6'2, but at the time I thought he was like 6'8 and 350 pounds, you know, big, massive guy. Had the billy club and all that stuff with the belt on. And Dr. Iapelli looks at me and says, you've just been admitted to River Edge Hospital. I was a minor at the time, so I didn't have much choice in it. Okay, I ended up spending 3.5 or 4 months there. My junior high school yearbook is signed by no one but people I was in treatment with. I still have that, you know, my junior year high school yearbook, I should say. That was my first treatment. And when I got out of there, I, you know, had worked on lots of stuff. We had worked on the grief that I had because both my parents had died already at that point. And, you know, poor David, he's got this alcoholic uncle and these things are going on. But, you know, I was working and I was getting A's and B's in school. I was a good kid for the most part, except for, you know, all the pot drinking and, you know, times when I ended up face down in my own puke in the front lawn and things like that. That, you know, was a minor deal. My family tells me I started drinking when I was 3 years old. They said anytime my dad put down a beer, I would pick it up. So my dad had to quit drinking beer because I was right there. Okay. And all that led up to that treatment, and I still didn't really buy the idea that I had a problem. It was the gin is why I threw up that time, so I just won't drink gin anymore. Okay. Or it was the rum at that time, and I just won't, you know, swig a half a whatever it was of rum. And I went to treatment, and I thought, okay, well, I dealt with my grief. I should be better now, and I'll go back to work at the same place and hang out. And, you know, my friends would say, oh, wait a minute, no, you're not smoking anymore, and pass it to the next guy. And that lasted for a little while, and then suddenly I was, you know, oh, let me just take a little puff. Okay. Ended up back in treatment, same place again, went to a halfway house, and all of that was just, you know, kind of precursors. And I was rolling through. Somewhere in the back of my head, I thought, maybe there's a problem, but I wasn't really sure. When I look at it now, all of that is part of my step one. All of that is part of me knowing and being told that I was powerless and that my life was unmanageable. I know today that it's not just that when I picked up, I couldn't put it down until it was all gone. That was part of it. You know, I was one of those people that, you know, I'm going to buy this eighth and I'm going to save it for the whole weekend. It's going to last. Yeah, sure it is. My sponsor, one of the greatest things he ever told me was that monkeys don't sell bananas, guy. No, we don't. That's not how it works. Okay? We don't. My sponsor's a wise man. He certainly is. When I got through with the halfway house, I went to college, managed to get through college. You know, I did the 5.5-year plan, but I managed to get through. And I moved, this was in Illinois. I'm from Chicago originally. And Chi-Town, all right, yes. Represent in the house back there. Do we miss the pizza? We miss the pizza. Pizza's an essential thing, people. You have to have pizza. I mean, if you think about it, there's all four food groups right there in one little pie. All four of them, just right there. And I had the weirdest experience when I first got sober. How do I eat pizza without drinking beer? Yeah. Yeah. I didn't get that. And then somebody said, why don't you ask some people from the program to go with you and have some pizza? And maybe you could drink iced tea or root beer instead of, really? My goodness, it was a radical idea, and Conan's was discovered, and I've been a happy pizza eater ever since. I had this idea when I graduated college and moved to Texas that I would be a social drinker. You know, I would just, you know, have a couple beers on the weekend, smoke just a couple joints every now and then, you know, not like I was doing before. I gave away all my paraphernalia, and I was never going to do coke anymore. That was just not going to happen. All the pharmaceuticals, all that was gone. And the weirdest thing happened. My first bar experience in Houston, they came around and collected drinks at 2 in the morning. What? I'm just getting started. Wait a minute, it's only 2. You know, I'm used to clubs in Chicago that didn't open till 4 in the morning. You know, that this was, you know, the real, and they wanted, all, so what do? I'm not fully toasted yet. You know, I'm not at that point that I've always tried to reach, that perfect equilibrium. So you talk to some other people who are also complaining about it, and guess what? I found an after party. Surprise, surprise. And what was at the after party? Cocaine, yes. Wow. And then all of a sudden, there I was again. Okay, all of a sudden. And I ran with that for another 3 years or so. I moved down here to work for Foley's Department Stores. I was a sales manager for Foley's, ended up at Bargain Creek Mall down the street. And I had 2 offices. I had one office that, you know, business was conducted in, and I had another office that had a big plate of glass on top of the desk. And that was business as usual. Okay, that was how that worked. And I had all kinds of things going on at the time. And, you know, I was working out. I was doing aerobics. I was going to Gold's Gym. I was, you know, walking out of the house in the morning with my briefcase and my workout bag and my new suit. And I was fine. You know, I was just fine. I had a brand new car I was making payments on. Everything was good. And then August 25th of 1989, all of that second office stuff finally caught up with me. And I got fired from the job that I was going to spend the rest of my life at. You know, I had this idea, this old school idea that you got one job and then you retired from that job. It's old school stuff. And that was pulled out from under me. And I got that last paycheck and I had this great idea. I know. I'll go sell some drugs. I'll take this and I'm going to double it and then triple it. And I don't have to work ever again. This is going to be my job full time. Yeah, it was. It was genius, wasn't it? Well, I get back home with my little score and going to go do my doctoring on it. And there's an eviction notice on the door of the apartment. Okay. It was something about spending all my money on drugs and being at the clubs and not paying my rent that the landlord didn't like. I don't know why they had a problem with that. You know, I had priorities. I had things I had to do first. And I broke into the apartment. It was my apartment. I wasn't really breaking into it, right? There's an eviction notice, who cares? Got my little stuff together, all these little baggies and all that fun stuff, and I head to the east side. Now, this was when it was still First Street. It wasn't Cesar Chavez yet. And there were some apartments down there, you know, that people hung at, and you could pull into the apartment, do some business, and pull out the back and go on your way, right? And when I pulled out the back, guess what? Police. The Austin police were waiting for me there. And they were out to get me. You know, they were. They were out to get me. yeah, me. And that's a four-step story. And there might be a couple of people in the room who've heard me tell this one. But, you know, I had on my four-step, I had the blessing of going to Joe and Charlie's Big Book Study when it was still Joe and Charlie. And we were at the DoubleTree Hotel, and it was the whole weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, of how the Big Book really works, how the program really works. And I had about 5 months sober at that time, and it was enlightening. The whole allergy thing, you know, I'd been sober for 5 months and all that, but it didn't really hit me until they broke it down. There's something about me that likes the intellectual explanation of things. And when they told me it was this allergic reaction, and you have these cravings, and this is what happens, and that it really is out of your control at that point, I had such a relief. Because I thought I was weak. I thought there was something wrong with me. You know, everybody else I knew, my cousins, these other people, they could keep using. They didn't have a problem. Why can't I be like them? And then they broke it down to me, and I understood from Joe and Charlie what it was really like. And I got the instructions on the four-step. I got the, you know, the long form, that the checks and all that stuff. And I jumped into my inventory. And Monday, right after that, you remember when I got stopped coming out of the apartment? Well, 5 months later is when they finally dropped an indictment on me. But see God's timing in this? I was sober. I was abstinent for a period. But then I got solution handed to me. I got the solution of the real program, the first 164 pages, and how it really worked, and then an indictment in which I was looking at 10 years. 10 years for possession, distribution, and all that, because, you know, I had this big thing and all that. But I was ready for it at that time. I had been sober for a while, and I had a program that worked. Okay? I had a program that worked. My first meeting... my home group was Far West Boulevard. It's not there anymore, the Unity Group. There was a little conference room that HEB had at one time. It was this training thing, and they converted it to a meeting place. And when they rebuilt that HEB and redid that little shopping area, that meeting disappeared. I just kind of regret that. That was where I started. That was my first real home group. And the first meeting I went to after I had gotten out of detox, I went to that meeting. It was the closest one to my apartment. And I heard a guy talk in the meeting who talked about, you know, he used to live on the street and collect cans at the on Guadalupe Street, and that was his alcoholic life. He'd been to prison. He had done all this stuff. And now, at this point in the meeting, he had started a house painting company or some kind of painting company, and he had done so well that he had other people running it, and he was learning how to play the saxophone again, and he was doing art, and he was, like, working part-time. And I heard that promise that said the fear of economic insecurity would leave us, and I thought, that's what's going to happen. I'm going to be rich, just like this guy, right? And then I won't have any fear anymore. That's not exactly what it says in that promise. The promise says the fear of economic insecurity will leave us. I don't have fear about it. It doesn't mean I have all this money. It just means I don't have to worry. That's all it means. I just don't have to worry anymore. I don't have to worry about anything because I know that the right thing's going to happen at the right time, and all I have to do is hang on and ride along with it. That's all I have to do. Okay, so this guy is, you know, I'm leaving the meeting, driving back to my apartment, and I notice he's behind me because I saw what truck he got in. I wanted to make sure he was, you know, driving a car that was going to be, you know, that he wasn't just lying to me, telling me something in the meeting. It had to be, you know, he had to be driving a Mercedes or something, but it was a big, giant truck. He's following me, and I'm like, man, I didn't talk in the meeting. I bet that's why he's following me, to see what's going on. So I reach over and roll down my window, and when we're at the light, he had pulled up next to me, and I said, hey, you know, I know I'm new at this, but next meeting, I promise I'll share. He looked at me like, who the hell is this guy? what does he know about? I don't know who this guy is. He didn't have a clue, but that's how self-centered I was. Everything was about me. It couldn't be that he just happened to live in the same neighborhood because that's where the meetings were. It was he was following me. He was following me. I kept a journal my first 90 days. And I know that I made 86 meetings in my first 90 days because I wrote them all down. I made the 9 o'clock meeting at Suburban Group, and this is what we talked about, you know, just a little journal stuff. And another sign of how self-centered I was, this journal is titled David's Big Book. Okay, this is my big book, right? This is how I'm going to do sobriety, right? I was so lost, but I still have that book today. And I can look at it and get so grateful that I'm not that person anymore. Things have changed so radically in my life thanks to recovery. It's an amazing thing, truly amazing thing. I hit bottoms that I was completely worthless. Okay, part of my story, part of what got me here was being suicidal. The first time, I took 70 sleeping pills and drank a 12-pack of beer. 70 and a 12-pack. And I survived that. I don't know why I survived that. I shouldn't have survived that. I expected to wake up dead. I'd gone through this whole elaborate ritual, you know, yeah, wake up dead. I know. that was my thinking, right? I went through this whole elaborate ritual. I drove to St. Louis. I was at Southern Illinois University in college, and I drove to St. Louis, checked into a hotel under a false name, threw my ID off the roof, you know, did all this ritualistic thing, and then sat down in the hotel. And I still owe that hotel and that maid a horrible amends because I threw up everywhere. I mean, everywhere, all over that whole hotel. And get this, guys, then, you know, I hadn't died, so then I got worried about myself. And I went to the hospital. I went to the emergency room because, you know, I didn't die. And when I told the doctors what I had done, they got worried about me, and they wanted me to go to the state hospital, you know, to the mental hospital. Wait a minute. And by that time, you know, I'd gotten everything out of my stomach. I was feeling a little bit better. No, guys, I don't need to go to the state hospital. I'm okay. Okay. And then they had a security guard, another one, come over and watch me in that little, you know, with the drapes around the thing in the emergency room. And the security guard was standing there just for me. And then he walked me. The state hospital was across the little quad there. It was all in the same medical complex in St. Louis. And he walked me over there. And then they made the fatal mistake of leaving me in the waiting room while the receptionist called the doctors or whoever it was to come get me. Well, there was a window. And so I escaped from the state hospital. I did. I tried to kill myself and didn't, and then I escaped from the state hospital. Now that's, you know, for us, that what normal person would be proud of the fact that they escaped from the state hospital? We got some hands up there in the background. Yeah. And I'll tell you, when I went back to school to get my master's degree in social work, I did my internship, one of my internships, at the Kerrville State Hospital. Okay. I still have the key they gave me, just in case. just in case. I might need that key someday. Just, I don't know. But it's there. Okay. So that was the first one. And I went back to school. I went back to my regular routine and all of that stuff. And then I met my first wife. First wife. I said first. Yeah. And if this isn't a perfect description of an alcoholic-addict relationship. My dealer was out of pot. So a friend of mine said he knew a guy. So we go to this guy's house, and he's hanging out with his girlfriend, smoking pot, you know, doing the regular things that we do, and we're, you know, doing our little thing. And his girlfriend was hot. She's from Venezuela, you know, here an exchange student and all this stuff. And we get to talking, and her birthday is August 15th, and my birthday is August 16th. It's meant to be. It's absolutely meant to be. Okay? So I invite her to a party at my house that I wasn't actually having. And she didn't leave after that. And, you know, things ensued, and we're living together, and her visa expires, and, okay, let's get married so you can stay in the country, and, you know, it's just a piece of paper. It won't matter. We're living together anyway. Man, relationships, you know, they tell you not to get involved in a relationship for a year when you get sober. And I said, yeah. And I didn't. I just had this idea. There was this woman I used to work with at the pizza place where I was a manager. And I knew her boyfriend was just a jerk. He was beating her up. You know, it was a sad state of affairs. They were living in a trailer in Florida. And I said, hey, I'm sober now. Come on up here to Austin and you can live with me. Bring your son. Yeah, that's fine. And I'll take care of you. And I'll save you from this relationship. Yeah, my knight in shining armor, you know. Well, one day she looked at me and said, you know, David, if you really loved me, you could tell me all your problems and you wouldn't have to go to those meetings anymore. Beginning of the end of that relationship. Thank goodness I had a sponsor I could talk to about it. Thank goodness I knew better somewhere in my head that really wasn't what I needed to do. But I had 6-7 months sober when she moved in, which was a mistake. So I can say it's a good idea to wait for a year because I didn't wait for a year and I almost relapsed over it. Okay. Almost relapsed over it. There's all kinds of those mistakes that I made that I wish I hadn't, but I've learned from them. I've learned from all of those wonderful little mistakes. And if you had told me that, you know, 30 years ago, I wasn't going to be alive still, let alone standing in front of a group of people talking about this chaos that got me here. Because that wasn't my only suicide attempt. Another suicide attempt, right before I actually got sober, my bottom, this time, was I cut my wrist. I cut my wrist the long way. Because, you know, you're supposed to do it the long way to, you know, make sure the veins stay open and all that stuff. I had just gotten in a fight with my girlfriend, who was the woman for me. Even though her boyfriend didn't think they had broken up yet. And, even though Bubba and I became very close, because we got to know each other well, because I went over to rescue her and the kids again, and he was there, and he chased me, and we're driving all over Austin, and he's actually shooting at me. And I finally pull into the cop shop. I get desperate enough. I pull in there at 7th Street. I pull into that parking garage so he would stop following us. That was the kind of relationships that we had. Me and Bubba were really close. And then I'd go over and slash his tire, and he'd come break my window, and, you know, that kind of stuff. Bubba is one person on my amends list I haven't seen yet. I don't know if Bubba's still alive. Okay. But I owe Bubba amends, and it's not because, you know, I made him waste bullets. that's not why. It's because, you know, I disregarded his feelings completely where Dee Dee was involved. Completely. And I repeated that again in sobriety later on. Mary was, I was already working in the field, and Mary was in this relationship, and we would sit out in the smoking area and smoke together, and she would complain about her boyfriend, David. Small world. And I said, you don't have to put up with that stuff. You know, you don't have to deal with that. And I encouraged her to leave him because, you know, what she was telling me was the truth, obviously. There's no way she contributed to any of that chaos that was going on. No. Because she was this pristine, sober, perfect person. You know, she had 9 years sobriety. She had to know all of this stuff, right? Well, as it turns out, she had contributed quite a bit because she did the same to me or with me, and she ended up relapsing. And part of Mary's relapse was she never did a ninth step. She had been sober. She had been going to meetings. She had been doing service work, but she could never bring herself to make amends. And so I had the opportunity to go to family program and become a member of Al-Anon. Okay, so I'm one of those double winners. Al-Anon, AA, and it's up more than that because I do CA, NA. Whatever A I can get my hands on to support me in this process, amen. Because they're all good. They're all part of the solution. I went to a conference. If any of you guys haven't been to a conference, an AA, NA, or CA conference yet, put it on your list of things to do. I can't tell you how wonderful conferences are. There's nothing like going to a hotel and standing in the big ballroom and saying the Lord's Prayer with 1,300 other people who are all sober, all having fun in sobriety. I was part of AUSIPAW, the Austin Conference of Young People in AA. I was 28 at the time. Yeah. And I was old for the group, but I was there. Okay. And we had a conference at the DoubleTree again. We had a great whole conference planning committee, and I was doing service work being part of this committee, and we had a band, and we had all this stuff planned. It was a good conference. And, you know, the conferences, you have speaker Friday night, you have workshops and stuff, and you have another speaker, and then more workshops. And I've been to conferences in New Orleans, Anaheim, Florida, all over the United States. And every one of them, I felt welcome because it's a bunch of alcoholics and addicts. You know, and they're just like me. Okay. But this conference, we had the great idea of doing a scavenger hunt after the band was done. You know, we're a bunch of kids. We're going to do, you know, something fun. So we had these teams for the scavenger hunt. And the goal was, at midnight when the band ended, you started the scavenger hunt, and you had to be back at the hotel at 6 a.m. with all your stuff, right? And one thing on the list was a police officer. Yes. You had to. So we went to Dunkin' Donuts. Yeah. Went to Dunkin' Donuts, and we talked a cop into coming back. And it turns out a bunch of people did. So when we got back, there were like 6 or 8 cop cars in front of the hotel. The management had a little bit of a problem with that. So they said they would never do another AA conference again. The Cocaine Anonymous conference I went to, the first one in Anaheim, the flyer said, here's your chance to stay up all night, talk until your teeth ache, become lifelong friends with people you've never met before, all this and not have to change your sobriety date. Yes, I'm in. It was Cocaine Anonymous in Anaheim, California, which of course is where Disneyland is. So we had 1,200 coke fiends in Disneyland. It was great. It was absolutely a wonderful thing, this conference was. Okay. Now, back to Mary and David for a minute. One of the conferences I went to was in Corpus Christi. It's the Coastal Bend Conference. They're still doing it. It's an annual thing. I highly recommend it. Not to mention, is it on the beach, but, you know, it's also a great way to get away for a while. This conference, the keynote speaker was talking about step 9 in men's. That was his main theme for the speaking. And then I went to a workshop on step 9. And I had just finished another inventory. I'm one of the people that feels like you keep doing inventories. There isn't about, you know, you do the steps once and then you're done. It doesn't work like that. It didn't work like that for me. Because every time I do another set of steps, I learn more about myself. Okay? It gets deeper. The second, fourth, and fifth step I did were all on things that I didn't even remember when I did my first one. Can I get an amen on that one? Yes. I didn't even remember this stuff. You know? And then, you know, slowly those wheels start turning. And then there's a couple of them that I put on my list because I realized, wait a minute, that didn't really happen that way. I had been lying to myself and everybody else about it for so long, I thought that was the truth. Right? And then, so I had to put it on the inventory. Anyway, I had done this inventory on relationship stuff. And this was after I had done family program and Al-Anon and all that stuff, and Mary and I had broken up. And I'm at the conference, and on the way back from the conference, I get a call, and a friend of mine said, hey, I got B.B. King tickets in San Antonio. You want to go? Oh, yeah. B.B. King? In person right there? Yeah. So instead of driving to Kerrville, which is where I was living at the time, I took a right and went to San Antonio. I met her outside. We get to the auditorium, and we go and find our seats. We're a little bit early. The lights are still up at this point. And we're sitting down. We're comfortable. And then all of a sudden, I look at the end of the row, and there's David. I had just done the inventory. I had just done the workshops. And then there he is. Okay? I hadn't planned it that way. In the concert in San Antonio and different. So I walk up to David. I said, man, I've just done some work, and I realize I owe you amends. All that stuff that Mary was telling me, I bought into it, and I blamed you for all the problems, and I'm really sorry I did that. Is there something I can do to make this up to you? Because that's what I was taught amends are. It's not just apologizing. It's being willing to do something to fix it. Okay? My sponsor told me, you know, if you stole $500 from somebody and you say, oh man, I'm sorry, I stole your $500, but it's still in your pocket or still up your nose, whatever that was, you haven't made any amends. But here's $5. I'm going to pay you $5 every chance I get until I pay it off. That's making an amends. Okay. So I asked David, what can I do? And he looked at me and said, man, just the fact that you said that, just the fact that you admitted that, that's all you need to do. That's all. We're cool. That's all it took. David and I are still friends. We're still friends. In the fellowship of this program. It's an amazing thing. Back to my Uncle Tommy. Okay. When I left his place to go to treatment the second time and then went to a halfway house, I didn't go back to that house. I was 18 when I left. And I was never going to set foot in there again because he was a drunken SOB and I was not going to have anything to do with him. Okay? And even in my, you know, amends process, writing the eighth step, he was on there, but I wasn't so sure. I was like doing that willingness prayer where, God, please let me be willing to be willing. Okay? And so the opportunity came up for me to go back home. And I got it now. I was working in the treatment business. I was an intern. I was a brand new intern in the business. And I got the idea. I'm going to go intervene on my uncle. Yeah. Yeah. That's the idea. I'm going to go get him sober. That was the plan. And I had treatment brochures. I cleared it with my boss. They would let him come into the same treatment center I was working in for free, you know, and we had all this stuff all set up. I had my big book. I had my treatment brochures, and I'm going to go up there and intervene on him. Well, the night before I was leaving, they talked me into doing a sweat lodge. If you haven't had a chance to do a sweat lodge yet, it is an intense 4 or 5 hour prayer ceremony. That's a short version of it. It's good for you. If you have a chance, try it. Native American spirituality, and it's intense. So I realized in that lodge, it's not my job to fix him. I owe him amends. It's my job to go up and admit that. So I left the treatment brochures. I took my book, but I left the treatment brochures. And I went up and I asked him, could I talk to you? Could we sit down and just talk? And I explained, you know, you took me in after my parents died. And instead of being grateful, I was just angry, nasty little 17, 18-year-old who ran your house crazy. And I'm sorry. I know I did these things. Could you tell me what else I did that affected you? Can you tell me, please, what I can do to make it up? And my uncle, who is the stoic, you know, hard, he was a principal. He was a school principal. Okay. He was a school principal that in Chicago, he had this set up in his garage. And okay, he had a Suburban that we parked backwards. And there was a snowplow that he had hanging up there. And he would lower the plow. And when other teachers would call and say, I can't come because I'm snowed in, no problem, I'll come get you. Okay, this was my uncle. And he'd just plow his way right over to whatever it was. He started crying. He started crying. The tears came out. I started crying. We hugged each other. My uncle and I, you know, the whole deal was that my father was his big brother. And he so wanted to be like his big brother and to help out when his big brother died, that he wanted to take care of me and step in and fill my dad's shoes. And then I turned out to be this drug addict running around crazy everywhere. Staying out all night, dealing drugs out of the house, you know, at 17 years old. It was not what he bargained for. But we fixed our relationship, all because I dropped the intervention and decided to make amends. When my twins were born, okay, my twins are 19 years old now. My twins have never seen me wasted. Isn't that a blessing? It's an amazing thing. They've never seen me wasted. Okay. My twins were both less than 2 pounds when they were born. They were very premature. They were in the ICU for 5 months. My daughter had 2 surgeries during that time. And that whole psychic thing they say about twins is true, because my son was more stable and doing better, and we moved him to like a subacute. And when we moved him, his O2 sat started crashing. He started doing badly. We moved him back into the same room with his sister. He was fine. He was fine after that. Okay? It's an amazing thing. And at that time when they were born, when we were doing that, I was at the hospital every day. I was in graduate school. I was already program director at La Hacienda, but I was going back to get my master's degree. Okay? And so I had full-time work, master's, and kids in the hospital, and I didn't use, folks. I didn't use. I had discovered, well, the meetings first, that it was my home group, 720 Club in Kerrville at the time, but I also had another home group that was AA Men, and it's this email group, okay? The way AA Men works is it's a listserv thing, and you know, somebody's the chairman, they post a topic for the week, and everybody just writes in and shares on the topic, right? And so when this was going on with my kids, I said, guys, I need some prayers. I need some prayers because I'm not sure how the hell I'm going to do this, okay? And I got prayers literally from everywhere in the world. Switzerland, the Philippines, England, all over the United States, prayers came in for these kids and for me and my wife, okay? And those kids that were less than 2 pounds, that that we were in the ICU and saw other kids dying around us, those two kids are fine. Those two kids are my little miracles. More of my little miracles. Okay? That's sobriety. That's the power of the higher power that I know now that I didn't know before. My higher power, when I first came in the program, because I was pissed that God took my parents. So God, you know, he may be out there, but he had nothing to do with me, right? So I had this huge resentment against God. And in my inventory process, I discovered with my sponsor that I was pissed that God didn't live or didn't run the world the way I wanted him to. So I had a resentment. That's when I identified that. But there's a book called Venus on the Half Shell, author Kilgore Trout. I don't know if anybody's familiar with him. Kilgore Trout's actually a fictional character that Kurt Vonnegut wrote. And then somebody else wrote a book. Anyway, in the book, God created everything, and they gave him credit for that. But at this point, he was just this ball of light, just this little fluffy ball of light that rolled around and got in people's way, and you'd kick him out of the way. Yeah, God, go ahead. You know, that was God for me when I first came in the program. But now I know that God is active in my life, that I would not be here standing before you guys if it wasn't for a higher power doing for me what I could not do for myself. I know that that's why I'm standing here. 3 suicide attempts, all the drugs I did, all the drinking, all the times I, you know, could have died behind the wheel, everything else that went on in my life, and I'm still here. And I have the privilege now of working with addicts and alcoholics. My life is full of blessings. One last thing. When I got out of detox that last time, I went to Oak Springs detox. I don't, you know. Familiar with Oak Springs? Yeah. Yeah. Highfalutin place Oak Springs was. We had cots, literally cots. And there were 4 of us in this one little room. And the guy next to me had shingles and he was throwing up in the garbage can next to him. And he was detoxing from heroin. And said, this was the, you know, this is what, the first treatment center when I was 17, you know, 2 psychiatrists that were, you know, catering. And we went out on these outings, all this stuff. This time, I'm in a cot. Okay. When I got out of there, I found myself needing a place to live because I didn't have one. And I had just gotten this part-time job, and the owners of this part-time place, it was carpet cleaning place. Okay, I went from Polo and Ralph Lauren selling stuff in suits at Foley's to cleaning carpets in a blue collar. Okay, and the people who owned this building were willing to co-sign on an apartment for me because I had just gotten evicted, so I couldn't get an apartment. Okay. And when I moved into this third floor apartment, it's up there, Anderson and Burnett. Okay. I got up to that third floor, and you know, there's that Catholic church right over there. Okay. I'm watching the sunset, and the sun is setting right in the middle of the cross. And I had to say, okay, God, I hear you. And I've been sober since. Thank you guys very much. Wow.